Hi, everybody, and welcome to the Cultural Studies podcast. My name is Toby Miller, and my guest today is
Tammy Parler from the Women's Sport Trust.
And Tammy, thank you so much for doing this. I'm really excited because I read the recent report you guys produced that we'll talk about a bit later, and was really excited and wanted to get in touch with you. But a cold call isn't always successful, but you were very kind to reply and say, maybe we can do this, and here we are. So, Tammy, I wanted to start by asking you what's currently preoccupying, dynamizing, interesting you here today, this week, this year?
Well, firstly, thanks for inviting me and really the cold call. It's always lovely to talk to new and interesting people. So I'm actually absolutely thrilled to be with you today. What's on my mind at the moment? Well, we're recording this on International Women's Day.
We are so, March
we are,
8th.
Yes.
All right.
And I run a organisation that campaigns for gender equality in sport. It seems appropriate, but I tend to take the day off on International Women's Day. You spend every other day of the year sort of banging the drum, and now on International Women's Day, it's sort of you hand it over and give everybody else a chance. I think the interesting thing that I'm finding this year is it hasn't been the noise around International Women's Day hasn't just been focused on March the 8th, which is the official day. It's really starting to grow out, and we saw International Women's Day posts sort of a good week before the actual day, and I'm sure we'll continue to see things afterwards. So it feels like the momentum is definitely building in that area.
Absolutely, and it's exciting. Although if we look at some of the statistics post, say, in the British context, the 2012 Olympics, participation in general across genders in sports hasn't really taken off the way it was supposed to, according to Tony Blair and David Cameron. But on the other hand, on the professional side, we've seen an extraordinary growth in women's sports, haven't we? And that's probably more relevant in terms of capturing the imagination of young women and girls, do you think?
Oh, absolutely. So the organisation Women's Sport Trust, I co-founded after being inspired by London 2012. So your note on 2012 is very relevant to me. At that time, I was and still am a sportswoman. Running my own martial arts academy within London, and I had never been exposed to women's sport before. I'd never saw it on television. I didn't see other female athletes. I was very focused on my own situation, and in many ways felt that, or accepted the fact that I was maybe a bit weird for being a woman who was heavily involved in sport. And when London 2012 hit, it really affected me quite significantly. It's sort of for the first time seeing elite role models out there, women that were like me, and women being given a platform in this industry, and then the sort of realization that, oh my gosh, it could stop. So the roots of our organization was around this can't stop with London 2012. And at that time, there were numerous organisations focusing on grassroots and participation. That seemed to be the acceptable place for women to be. You could talk about sport as far as helping young girls, and that's incredibly important. My own club is a grassroots club. It's essential. But there was no one really focusing on the commercial side, the elite side at all. It was almost like the space we weren't allowed to be in. So that was our focus. When you're trying to get the whole system to start working together, you can't just focus on one aspect of it. And that's really what it felt like the industry was doing. It was I'm not sure that you can overly focus on participation, but it was, if you imagine a whole sort of, the industry is a wheel that's sort of turning, an inflatable wheel. And each bit of it, each bit of that piece of that pie is is so participation and grassroots is one part of that inflatable bit. And it was this overly inflated bubble, and the rest of it, sort of fandom, commercialization, talent pathways, all that sort of stuff felt underinflated. So that became our approach.
And that's the irony for me, I guess, in my earlier comment, what I was getting at was that the participation stuff hasn't really worked, to be honest.
Yes.
But the professionalization part has. I was
With
listening today to an interview with a former BBC radio football caller, Mike Newell, who was quite a famous commentator in his day, who's more or less said in this interview that his one regret was that he retired before it would have been possible to be calling England versus whoever women's games in the national contest, because women's sport had been such an had had such an extraordinary surge in significance since his retirement, I don't know, 10 years ago or whatever.
Yeah, I think we've got to understand that all these things, whether it's actually the elite side or participation side, it's a whole complex puzzle. And there's no magic bullets, but all these actions that we're taking, these little actions, well, hopefully is about that changing momentum. You know, 10 years ago, when founded the Women's Sport Trust, it was the link between elite athlete visibility and participation that nobody really got that. It was all about, no, that bit's not important. What's important is sort of your mum and all that sort of stuff. And there was a lack of understanding about this link between those two. Now it seems absolutely bonkers. Of course, seeing female athletes, women on TV inspires younger people to do something, and older people as well. Yes, of course, you need the mum, you need the facilities, you need all those other stuff. But it's like I was saying before, this is a whole part of the puzzle, and we can't expect one little bit to actually be the magic bullet and change
That
everything.
fixes everything.
You
And of
know,
course,
from the participation, what about facilities? What about talent pathway? What about access? You know, there's so many bits to focus on.
if you think about the British context, the austerity policies since 2010 are seeing public pools and gymnasia and other facilities diminished radically, and they're still closing all the time, just like public libraries in Britain. I think that's
So
another
this.
factor, as you say, it's facilities. It's not just rah, rah, rah participation. It's professionalism and marketing and building infrastructure and maintaining those and connecting, creating these pathways. I think that's a term you've used a couple of times, right?
Yes, and yet facilities, and then also access. If you look at who has access, like a football pitch, for instance, is that in a lot of cases the men's team will have priority access to those. The facilities are there, but the times that you're able to use those then become placed in. So it's also about what's the data we're collecting. You could say that there's a 50-50 availability of facilities, but that 50-50, one could be getting, I don't know, 6 o'clock in the evening, and the other could be getting 2 o'clock in the morning. I mean, that's not so. There's multiple different ways to look at this, and we've also got to recognise that there's a system in place already, so it's very easy to create something from scratch. But if you're actually working with a system that's been in place for, you know, decades and decades, to actually change power and change how things are shared is challenging.
So you were inspired to start the trust because you stopped being like a freak as a professional woman athlete.
Yes, I suppose. Yeah, I suppose that's a
In
very good.
part, I mean, you saw there were other people like you, right, who were excellent at sports and loved sports and so on. And the trust began. What did you think of what it would be like when you started it? What was the idea of what it would do? And how does that relate to the first decade and a bit of
Yes.
history of
Yeah.
your business?
So right at the start, there were also Stories in the media of female athletes struggling financially, and thought that, I've got a tenner, but and if I can find nine other people, we've got 100 quid, and we can give it to that female athlete, and she can buy the spare wheel for her car and get to training. So it was really the beginnings of the charity was very much focused on grant giving, these small little grants. That's and it was as well, it was this extra thing. I had my own business, my own martial arts school that was very successful. I set it up with Joe Bostock, who runs a leadership organization focused on diversity and inclusion. Her business was very successful as well. This was something, an extra thing to do on the side. But we got into the system. We started talking to people, and back then it was really easy to talk to significant people because nobody was interested in women's sport. So we got to talk to some incredible people, and it became clear very quickly that these small little grants weren't the answer. They weren't going to solve anything. There were systemic issues that we needed to look at. So we quickly did a quickly turned around what we were doing, and understood that we needed to be focused on leadership and the system itself. And we created three pillars that were about leadership or elite athlete role models, visibility, and then the commercial landscape as well. And those early days, what we've done as an organization has changed over time. We've been around for over a decade now, and through that decade, the industry has changed. So what we have done has changed as well. We're focused on, Joe actually coined the phrase right at the start, that we wanted to move women's sport from worthy to irresistible. And it's which I love, and I
That's what I'd
thank
like
you.
in my life, by the way, professionally and
Yes.
personally. If you've got any quick hints on how to move from being worthy to desirable, that would be, or is
Yeah, well,
this?
that's look at women's sport. I mean, that's the journey it's on, and that's the journey we're trying to push. Everything we've done has been about refocusing
Beautiful.
the industry and getting them to see the things that they should be seeing but can't see on this journey to irresistible. Bringing people together, convening, changing conversations, and taking action where we need to.
And in terms of the people involved, you've got some very notable folks involved, and supporters and so on. I wonder if you could talk a bit about cultivating that world of support, which for any charity, be it highly professional or very much on the street, is pretty essential, right?
Yes, I mean, as I said, right from the start, we were able to get to people that I think would be much harder to get to now. It's a moment in time. After London 2012, there was this desire for women's sport to grow, but it still was very much run by outliers. It had very little budget, etc. So when we reached out to people, they said yes, they'd meet us. So, at our first event, we had Claire Balding and Judy Murray and other people like this. One of the first people I spoke to on the phone was Tanny Gray Thompson. We had a meeting with the chief exec of UK Sport at the time, and these are, Joe and I weren't from this industry, so it's I think what people realised quite early on was actually this wasn't a, we're a charity that, which means that we're not commercially focused. We're not commercially driven. We're commercially focused, but we're not commercially driven. And it was, people seemed to understand that it was for the wider purpose. They saw our intentions were, oh, for want of this bit of a naff way of putting it, we had pure intentions. We honestly wanted to and still want to move the industry forward and to make a better world. And people really, There's lots of people with that same ambition, particularly with in women's sport,
Just to give some
and it so
context.
it gathers momentum.
Just to give some context for non-British listeners, some of the women you mentioned, Claire Balding is a very famous sportscaster, maybe the premier sportscaster in Britain these days.
Yes.
Murray was a highly ranked tennis player and became a very important tennis coach and is extremely prominent in British sports. And so you're and you also mentioned a Paralympian, a famous politician as well, member of the House of Lords, and so on. So you
Yes.
have people who are highly prominent in British life. And one thing they share, apart from being either excellent in sports or excellent in sports commentary and policy, is that they have a media presence. And I wanted to get onto that for a moment, if we could. The role the media play in all of this, both in terms of the things that you are concerned with as a charity, and the way in which they are, from my perspective, increasingly engaging with women's sports, both in the audiovisual sector in Britain and also in the traditional journalistic print sector.
Yes, well, it's right from the early days, seeing female athletes, seeing women's sport, to me, it's that's the thing that touched me. It made me feel like it increased my self-worth. So that link between what you see is in the heart of what we do and absolutely essential. It gives a platform, it gives it brings attention. It's the we put out so we've constantly right from the start been focusing on the media side and trying to increase that visibility. Back in I think it was around about 2019, we did a piece of research that ended up being called Closing the Visibility Gap. That was about looking at the visibility sort of landscape, looking at seeing what, well, delving greater into that. And what one of the big things that came out of that research was this lack of data in women's sport. Sorry, we're doing this on Zoom, and there's a random thumbs up sign that has just come up, which was obviously, somebody in cyberspace has just been agreeing with what I've been saying. How bizarre.
Good grief. That's a bizarre.
Anyway,
I'm just let me just look at okay. Well, I'm just
yes.
hitting the button reactions to see whether I did that, but
No, I mean it came up on my screen, so
I've
it's highly
gone
bizarre. But I
horrifically
think it
wrong. I
shows that the universe knows that this is the right thing to be focusing on. Anyway, going back to that, it showed this piece of research showed or underlined two things. Firstly, that visibility drives engagement, and if we wanted to get more commercialization into women's sport, if we wanted to bring more attention, if we wanted to grow women's sport, it needed to increase its visibility. We needed to prove that there was an audience out there. Secondly, it showed that there was a lack of data, that there wasn't enough data out there in the industry. So we started to, no one was interested in that either. No one, so we started to push it out ourselves. We got access to BARB audience data around broadcast data, and we started to put together reports. We now do these on a quarterly basis, so we've been doing it for the past 3 years, and they've become much more sophisticated as we've gone through the years, and actually as women's sport has been developing in this country. But we started pushing these reports out on a quarterly basis and using that as a catalyst to pull together decision makers within the industry. So before each report, we pull together a think tank of the big broadcasters in the UK, the rights holders, social platforms, etc. Everybody who has a role within visibility, and we pull people from the most senior positions in to look at the data we've got and talk about the barriers and the obstacles and what we need to do next. So that has actually changed decision making within the UK. In addition to that, we also believe that this data was important to get out publicly. So, as well as pulling these behind closed doors conversations together, we then push it out into the ether. And it means that a lot of people, there's a lack of funding within women's sport. Organizations don't have the funding to do this themselves. So by pushing that into the industry, you've now given the organizations the tools they need to actually start having the conversations they need to have around the growth of their own sport or attracting commercial investment, etc. So it's been a significant piece of work that has really pushed things forward in this market.
But when I look at that research, which is incredibly valuable for academics, by the way, and hence, in a minor way, significant for the women and men that we teach in courses about communications and sports and so on. But one of the things you point to is that in the UK market, lots of sports are mostly the province of Sky, but Sky is behind a paywall and has very few people watching it. So most people watching sports are watching them on ITV and the BBC. And their record on women's sports outside things like the Olympics isn't so great, is it? Still.
I would argue that actually, and I think Sky are
Okay.
doing some incredible things of, as far as how they've supported women's sport in the in things like netball and
Oh,
their
sorry.
golf with their golf cup.
I meant BBC and
Sorry.
ITV as the
Oh,
public, as the
yes,
football stations.
absolutely.
The
I think
BBC and
sort of.
ITV record isn't great. Sky's is much better. Yes.
Oh, but and also I would counter that as well, saying
Okay.
that under Barbara Slater, she had a desire to push forward women's sport and the growth in coverage over the past few years has been enormous. And I think the free to air, so BBC, ITV, etc., are so important for this stage of women's sport as well. And our most recent report points to that, the importance of free to air coverage, because we're in early stages of fandom. We're still understanding women's sport fandom. We're still trying to attract a bigger audience and gain attention, get it into the living rooms of people who wouldn't normally be watching it. So that is really where free to air comes into its own. It's also, I think, it's also a challenge as the market begins to grow, the rights fees are going to continue to grow as well. So how much broadcasters, what properties they're able to bid for, et cetera, is going to it's going to become a more challenging market, I think, which isn't necessarily a bad thing.
Well, it might be very interesting if, as one suspects will happen, in the next 5 or 6 years in men's football, not just in Britain, but across Western Europe, the leagues slash the clubs decide that they won't sell TV rights. They will become the broadcasters. And they won't sell them to Amazon or Facebook either. They want all the revenue from consumers to come to them. Now that's risky because it means you suddenly lose billions of pounds or annual price in revenue. But it also opens up, if it happens, a huge amount of space on television.
Yes, I suppose it is going to be really interesting to see how this whole landscape develops. I sort of when I hear things like that, I there's part of me that thinks, what's the point of sport? All these they're going for platforms, ideally, so they're taking the data and the more money and all this sort of thing. But I think as an industry, we need to think about what the whole purpose is behind sport. And I hope that women's sport can actually start to change people's or remind people that that's a key question that we need to answer. So it's I'm really I don't mean that we shouldn't go for bigger commercial deals and get more financing and investment. Absolutely. And within women's sport, we need more investment. It's absolutely essential. But I think it's important that we keep asking the question, for what purpose? So it isn't just about getting more money. It isn't just about getting more ticks on your Instagram, whatever, and everything is. What is this enabling? And sport has the most incredible platform that can really impact society. So I hope that some, because I'm more focused on women's sport, obviously, but I hope that women's sport can lead society in a really positive way. And also get proper investment in to do that.
Sure. I wonder if we could go back a little bit to your biography, if that's okay,
Yes.
and ask you, Tammy, a bit about it, because you said that in a way it was a shock to you 12 years ago to realize there were so many women athletes all over the world. Growing up, were you in a sporting family at all?
No, not really. My family isn't interested in sport. I used to watch Wimbledon with my mum on TV
Yes.
when I was about 10 years old, but that was it. When I was 11, we moved to America. So as an 11-year-old, I started living in Chicago, and I was there for 11 years before coming back to the UK. So I suppose, significant part of my upbringing, that junior high school, college, was informed by being in America. And when I was in America, I woke up one day and no idea why, no concept of why, I decided I wanted to do karate. That was before Karate Kid and all those sort of things. So I have no idea where that came from. But my mum, I've talked about role models and things. My mum took me to the local martial arts school, which was a martial art called Hapkido, and there was a Korean grandmaster there, and I started training under him, never stopped, really. I became an instructor in his academy. I had immigration problems, which forced me back to the UK. And when I came back here, I was very clear that I wanted to keep in my sport. So I started up a club. I was in Lincoln at the time, and I set this up in Lincoln, and I did my proper job and had the club in the evenings. I then moved to London, set up a London school, continued with my proper job, and had the club in the evenings. And then I felt I'd always, probably since I was 15 years old, wanted to be a Hapkido master and have my own school and do this full time. So I thought, I don't want to get to an older age and think, what if I'd done that? So I worked towards reducing my proper job and developing my school more, and then I took the plunge. I quit my normal job and I went full time in my martial arts school, was doing classes mornings, afternoons, evenings in central London when London 2012 hit, which changed my life and the trajectory. But my proper job, I've always been in learning and development. So that idea of untapped potential and that curiosity of wanting to sort of learn and grow is deeply ingrained in me. And it's the same sort of within martial arts as well. That's about uncovering your potential. So the charity as well is about untapped potential of women's sport. So there's a definite, and it has a curiosity to it, and the reports that we put out are always trying to learn what's the next thing and how do you, that's a lot of the joy I get from doing this, is that women's sport isn't sorted. There's still so much to learn. So I've got a bit of a higgledy-piggledy career, but not if you look at it from that development and learning growth sort of view.
And was that something that you got interested in back in Chicago,
Yes,
Michigan.
absolutely. I think, well, as I say, I started the. I don't know, it's hard to tell when you've been involved in something for so long, whether it's personality or whether it's something that sort of because of an exposure, I don't know. But starting this martial art as some 11-year-old, the grandmaster was son of a Buddhist monk, so I grew up reading a very unusual girl. I grew up reading the Tao Te Ching and Buddhist scriptures and all that sort of stuff. That was my. The thing that I was most exposed to, and the thing that I found, absolutely interesting. I couldn't get enough of Buddhist and Taoist philosophy, etc. So I think that probably affected my growth as well. But there's also something in me. I just want to. You feel there's just potential, untapped potential that you just. Want to get to grips with, and also the joy of when I coach, being part of helping somebody open up their potential as well, realizing that they can do something. It's incredibly rewarding.
And was the world of martial arts a welcoming one for you in Hapkido as a young girl? And
Interesting. Yeah. I'd say yes and no. I felt very welcomed in the school. I felt very absolutely. It was a place that being a young girl that had changed, has moved to a different culture, and I was quite shy. I felt very weird. I was this English person and quite socially awkward. But within that martial arts academy, I felt like I had a place where I belonged, absolutely. And people would take me under their wing, etc. The flip side of that is I was often the only girl in the room with, and most people in the room with me were men at least 15 years older than me. I didn't find that weird in any way. I look back at it and think, oh, that's unusual. But it didn't occur to me at the time. So, yes, it's a funny thing. I think and again, with when London 2012 came, the shock of seeing other women like me out there. Because it kind of made me realize that I hadn't seen them very much before. So I'm not sure if that answers your question. So a bit of
No,
both,
I
really.
appreciate it. I appreciate it. I really wanted to know a bit about how welcoming the sport was to you, but also, I guess, to think more broadly about what in so many domains of sport has been marginalization. I mean, it just makes me think of the fact that it's only a little over 50 years ago that women's football became legal in Britain,
It's
right?
bonkers, isn't it? Absolutely bonkers.
And women weren't allowed to run the marathon in the United States 60 years ago, 50 years ago. I
Well,
mean,
sport is a or has been a very male dominated domain, and it's a place where men can be, I don't know, it's a very male environment. But it's changing, and same the other spheres like I don't know, stock markets and finance and all and tech and all that sort of thing. I think sometimes it's about changing mindsets of when you include, it doesn't necessarily mean it can mean less for you, but it doesn't need to be. We can have inclusive environments. We can actually diversity improves things when we have more in it. It makes for a whole better experience. But yes, it's been a journey. I think a lot. I think if you look back in sport and things before my time, it was a case of if you did this, you might I don't know, you might lose your womb or you might. And the thing about five sets and three sets in tennis,
It's
you know,
still bizarre.
it's sort of that women couldn't do. I mean,
It's
these are
completely bizarre. And I
ridiculous
personally,
assumptions.
I guess my view is the three-set model is the right one. But men are being exploited and being expected in these top tournaments to play five sets, which they don't do in most competitions. It's only in the really big ones that they have to play best of five to win. I'm sorry. It's absurd. No wonder they all have these terrible injuries. The women's model is the model from which men should learn. But regardless of that, Tammy, I had just a couple more questions for you. And then after those, if that's okay with you, I wanted to throw it back to you for you to add anything you'd like to what we've discussed. Does that sound okay?
Yes, absolutely.
All right,
Absolutely.
lovely. So my first one is to ask you, what do you think the main challenges are here and now for growing women's sport?
Oh gosh, I mean, there are so many challenges. And you can look at it, you know, if I go back to that analogy that I did at the start, this wheel that's turning and lots of different spokes or whatever you want to think of it. There's from talent pathway to professionalizing to more data, health and wellness of athletes, facilities, fans and marketing, school access. I mean, you could point at so many different areas. We're focused in a particular section, so that's sort of visibility and commercialization and et cetera. I think we're seeing that still the importance of free-to-air coverage, which we spoke about earlier, understanding how to use digital platforms better, understanding audiences better. And realizing there's not a one size fits all when you look at broadcast or attendance data, it can be very different. Value is, I think, is a massive thing that the industry is trying to understand at the moment, is sort of how do we demonstrate value within women's sport? Because a lot of the metrics that we use, the traditional metrics, are focused on reach their focus, but women's sport offers something else. That it's more around IP, it's more around brand value. So how do we quantify those to enable women's sport to get the share of revenue that it deserves? So that's a massive question that the industry is asking at the moment.
Big challenge. It makes me think of back to the 60s and early 70s when the Women's Tour got its first major sponsor, Virginia Slims. I don't know if you know this story. And they had a big campaign in the US where I also lived for many years. And the campaign was, "You've come a long way, baby. Here's your own cigarette." But there's always been a connection between product merchandising and marketing and the growth of professional sports, rightly or wrongly. It used to be, in the case of, say, men's football in Britain, the local manufacturer who would have a works team, in a sense, that he would run. And these were men, and this is the origin of much of northern football, in particular in the UK, but also rugby league. And of course, the same in Germany. And these teams would be marked, either formally or informally, as connected to the particular industry or corporation of the town. And then you get into more of a sponsorship world. And the sponsorship world has become crucial in so many sports like tennis and motor racing and so on, and on into the sponsorship even of almost of bodies, right? And the world of influencers. So it seems to me that this is still an area that's unfolding and unfurling, and a lot of it is awful, but it is almost inevitable if people want to develop sports. My last question before, as I say, throwing to you for things you'd like to add or maybe subtract, is about health issues. And you mentioned the idea that one would lose one's womb if one did pole vaulting for, or ran the marathon or whatever. All these wonderful excuses. People may not know this. There was no women's marathon in the Olympics until the mid-80s, right? And there are still distances that are sort of deemed to be more for men than for women. I think this year's Summer Olympics in Paris will be the first one ever that'll be sort of 50-50 in terms of registered athletes. But there's a long way to go when it comes to dedicating medical and other scientific research into women athletes when contrasted with the amount that is dedicated to men, to male athletes. And it seems to me this is especially important in some areas like gymnastics, where women's bodies or swimming have been manipulated through drug treatments for decades. I mean, most notoriously, way back in the past, right? And but also there is this case now of the number of young women, professional football players around the globe, lots here in Spain, but also in Britain, who are getting anterior cruciate ligament injuries, and nobody really knows why. And there's still a dearth of research. So I wondered about that area and whether this is somewhere that more attention needs to be given. I'm not saying it's your trust's duty to give it,
No,
but it seems to me that
yeah,
governments
absolutely.
and pharmaceutical companies that are the two traditional sponsors of research into medical things need to dedicate many, many more resources. And I wondered where that sits with your understanding of things, both as a person in the trust, but also as a practitioner, as an athlete myself, and as somebody who has been involved in running schools for athletes.
Yes, absolutely. So the big sort of health and wellness of athletes is absolutely essential, and it's really it's been one of the wonderful things about the growth of professional sports within the UK is now we're starting to look at that area more because we want our teams to win, and we want to, you know, this naturally you start to look at performance and this gets highlighted. There have been studies, you know, ACL and all that sort of stuff. So before the Olympics, before I set up the Women's Sport Trust, I did a master's in strength and conditioning. So, and understanding the different structures of a woman and how a leg, for instance, sits into the hips because we've got childbearing hips and the way in which power is then goes up a kinetic chain is all different, and how etc. and the what that will do to knees and to ankles etc. There has been research out there for quite some time. Whether people have looked at it or not and done anything with it is a different thing. That said, as well, there's also a dearth of it, so there's not enough, and you can understand. You can understand why there isn't. So, from someone who's had to do a dissertation, etc., when you're putting together a scientific whatever, you're trying to remove as many variables as possible. And having a woman as part of the focus group that you look at is quite challenging because we have hormonal fluctuations. So, where we are in our hormonal cycle will influence things. So if you are somebody who's doing a scientific paper and you're trying to get rid of as many variables as possible, naturally, you know, that might be one area that you don't look at. Also, if you look at a lot of the papers that have been put out and who are publishing, etc., there's a gender bias within that. So there are other reasons as well, that has brought us to this point. I think it's interesting to understand why we're at this point, but then know what we have to do differently now. And I'm just heartened by the fact that we're getting this bigger emphasis now because of the professionalisation of women's sport, that people are starting to draw focus to not only more scientific research being done, but then how do we, what do we, what's the standard of the strength and conditioning coaches that we're bringing in? What's the understanding of a coach on how energy changes when you're at different stages in that hormonal cycle? What is it okay to talk about and what is it not? You know, all those sorts of things are, we're at this point where we're able to start having those conversations and then we're able to make different choices.
Thank you for that. And As I said to conclude, Tammy, I'd love it if you'd perhaps add something that you think we haven't covered or go back to something we have and enrich it further.
Yeah, I suppose the one thing that comes to mind, and I mentioned this already, is that is I want us all to keep thinking about what's the point? What is the point of anything we're doing? What's the purpose? How do we demonstrate value to continue to be curious and ask that next question, why is something this way? And why are we doing this? What's the purpose behind everything? So we're pushing for more money, we're pushing for bigger audiences, whatever we're pushing for, we still need to do that, but why? So we don't sort of start to create something, because women's sport is in this really crucial moment of it is creating an industry, and it's creating the future that will then become very harder to change. So yeah, just underlining that point around reflecting on what's the purpose of
What's the
sport.
purpose? This why sport question, and not just privileging growth for its own sake, but
Yes,
working on what
exactly.
all this is for. That's the question that's foundational. But what you're saying to us, as I understand it, is when you get an answer to that, it's always going to be provisional. You need to keep going back to that question.
Yes,
Right.
absolutely. Because right now the industry is so noisy. So it's people have started, we've been banging the drum and saying, look, women's sport opportunity, there's an opportunity. I promise you, there's an opportunity. Look, there's an opportunity. And now people have gone, oh, there's an opportunity. And they're jumping in, and it's become really noisy, and lots of people are wanting to take their bit of the pie and to, you know, get to capitalize it on it and all that sort of stuff. So at this point, when people are jumping in, we've just got to keep saying, remember why.
This is a wonderful question. I think it's something that the English Premier League of men's football, for example, and the Indian Premier League of men's cricket have completely forgotten if they ever asked it. So I think the question is important for all sports, but in not just for all sports, for all the things that we do. So thank you so much, Tammy. It was really wonderful having the chance to meet you and record this conversation with you. I've learned so much from reading about the trust and reading its reports, and I've learned even more chatting to you today.
Well, thank you for having me. It's been a fun conversation.